Dear Mom, I know you've tried to protect me from who I am, and you've said my life before you adopted me doesn't matter, but it does matter. It matters because I still have visions of the place where I was born. I've heard all the whispers. I know what happened in that town where I was born. And I know you've tried to protect me from its horror for 19 years. Well, today I'm going back to that little abandoned town called Gatlin. Home to the truth. Love, Hannah.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Children of the Corn series, part of the 3-Minute Retrospectives look at the film adaptations of author Stephen King.
Give yourself. It's his will.
Join Garrett.
Don't underestimate the power of my vision.
Matt.
He speaks to me always, but today he is displeased.
And Adam.
Is this how they come to a complete stop in California?
As they find out who of the three of them really agrees with he who walks behind the rose.
He who walks behind the rose will decide your fate.
Will the three podcasters survive this trek through rows and rows of corn?
I got your eternal flame right here!
Find out next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Come on, let's go!
He Who Walks Behind the Rose, we podcast for you, starting with Stephen King's Children of the Corn, released March 9th, 1984. Budget on this was $1.3 million. Stay tuned, boys. Box office, $14.6 million, and this is directed by Fritz Kirsch. So, after months away, we are back to conclude Night Shift. Now, Goudreau, I want to talk to you real quick. See, when we started this retrospective, me and you, we were the King veterans. We read Night Shift. We knew of this book. We knew of lots of his work. But since we've started, our trusted colleague over here picked up a copy, went on vacation on a cruise, and read Night Shift for the most part. Now, Matt, I want to start off with a little game. Adam texted us that he read a story in this that he loved. I want you and I to guess which story it is.
Okay, so first thing you got to do then is open up my table of contents.
Yes.
I'm going to say for the record, that is the term I used.
Capitalized L-O-V-E-D, by the way.
Yep.
He was also very coy, though. He didn't tell us which one, so this...
No.
And neither of us have the advantage, because we're both in the dark.
Exactly, yeah. I haven't texted Adam about this since. I wanted to save it for this particular moment. I'm going to guess, because I think I know my best friend pretty well, I'm going to guess I Know What You Need is the story he loved. Matt?
I am going to go with, since I know he talked about it firsthand, that he has a connection, I'm going to say Quitter's Inn.
Interesting. Adam?
I'm going to say, well, no, hang on. Neither one of you are correct. Okay. Now, I've enjoyed being able to read these out of order because it doesn't really matter. But the one that I did say, I said, oh my God, I found a Stephen King story I loved, was I Am the Doorway.
Oh my God. God damn. It's the one that the cover is based on when they did the bandage with the hands. Oh, that's interesting.
Wow. It's really interesting based on what we're about to be discussing because that's the cover of the book that is on the dashboard in this first film.
Yes, it is. All right. So let's get to the first of 11 Children of the Corn movies we're going to be talking about. Stephen King's Children of the Corn. It was released 1984. I did not see this until much later. It did have kind of a reputation. I remember people saying it was pretty scary at the time. I didn't see it, like I said, until much later, and I still have thoughts on that, and we'll get to it. But Matt, when did you hear of and or watch this original version of Children of the Corn?
Well, I'm going to answer part B first. All of these are first-time viewings. I have never seen any of these.
Okay.
And this transitions into part A because a lot of people that I respect tell me I can skip all these movies and I would still have a complete cinematic Rolodex. And I took them at word. And look, some of these were pretty hard to find up until the age of streaming. So I was not going to shed tears if I went the rest of my life on this planet without seeing Children of the Corn Genesis. Or insert title here. Even the first one. And The reason why I didn't see it is because I've read the story. It's not one of my favorites in the Night Shift anthology. And B, when you look at the track record up until Children of the Corn as far as Stephen King on film, all the other installments were directed by filmmakers that I either really like or have deep roots in cinema. So when you scroll through, look at this list. Brian De Palma, okay, David Cronenberg, Stanley Kubrick, John Carpenter, Fritz, insert last name here. One of these things is not like the other.
Now, Adam, you and I grew up together. Did you have any idea about this before we started this retrospective, this particular film and its reputation?
The only thing I've known, and it's why, much like Matt, by the way, these are all going to be first-time watches for me. Hopefully, they will be complete watches for me. I can't guarantee anything. But I feel like since I was young, every single one had a reputation as just B-movie schlock. And for that reason, I didn't avoid him because it was King. I just never had a desire. Even with my love for some goofy, cheesy 80s and 90s horror, these would never, ever been on my radar until now.
The only reason they were on my radar is because I remember when they were released and I was working at the video store. And when Dimension acquired the rights, they would literally release one every couple years just to keep those rights. So I watched a few of those. And I will say, yes, it's going to be a chore to get through all 11 of these. However, I will say there's at least one of the later entries that I really like. Remember liking. I haven't watched it since. But I remember watching it a few years ago and thinking, man, that was pretty good for a Children of the Corn movie. At least one. But yeah, it is going to be a chore to get through these, the last of the Night Shift. But let's get to the first Children of the Corn movie, how this came about, which is actually an interesting story. So this was acquired by a producer by the name of Donald B. Borchers. Keep that name in mind, guys. He's going to come up way later down the road. But he acquired these rights as he was a part of New World Pictures, and he got his friend Fritz Kiersch, who he worked with in the advertising industry, to come aboard and direct this. And at that point, they had a script by Stephen King. New World Pictures read the script, and New World Pictures disregarded it. They were like, we don't like this. We're going to go a different direction. So they hired this guy, George Goldsmith, to do a once-over on it, and he made some changes to the story, which we'll talk about as we get into the movie. And there was a conference call between the producers, King, and Goldsmith, and King told Goldsmith, you don't have any idea about horror. And Goldsmith says, you don't have any idea about cinema. And they went like that for a little bit. And in the course of this, when Kiersch signed on, he signed on with a $1.3 million price tag, as I mentioned in the beginning of this. But after his name was taken off the writing screenplay credits, King insisted, if you're going to keep my name above this title, I want a $500,000 price tag on that, making Kiersch have an $800,000 budget to work with on this film. Matt, that's not a lot of money, is it?
No, it's not. And with that information in mind, it explains why this movie feels so cheap and slapdashed. Let's also mention, and I want to put this out there right now, since we're not reviewing these in order of theatrical release per se, and when you look at Stephen King's movies up to this point, like, he did his take on vampires, he had done The Haunted House with The Shining, he did Inanimate Objects with Christine. This one's touching on a subgenre that has kind of become a trope at this point, and that's evil kids. And it makes sense that they would do that as a Stephen King adaptation, because that idea has sold basically as early as Village of the Damned. That's kind of the first big, as far as like a one that had some staying power. And I'm talking evil kids as far as without demonic possession, like The Exorcist or The Omen, literally The Bad Seed, which I guess would predate Village of the Damned. So this was, pardon the pun, ripe for a cinematic adaptation, especially in the 80s and the days of Nancy Reagan's War on Drugs, Just Say No, All the stuff about teenage delinquency and R-rated movies are going to make our children be violent monsters. This was the perfect time to make Children of the Corn.
And I remember, even as a kid, going through video store shelves and seeing that little hand holding that sight against the red sky. And even that, as a kid, it frightened me. Because just thinking of a kid holding that and committing a murder was really, really frightening to me at the time. All right. Well, I have more of this stuff, but I want to say one more thing, though. So the cinematographer of this movie, what an interesting guy this guy is. He has a lot of aliases. Because one piece of his resume that he worked on was he did the cinematography
on Deep Throat, as well as other porn films from back in the day. So he has gone from doing lots of porn films to doing one corn film. But he went on to do The Prowler and Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter. So he put together quite a resume. But when you come from porn, like I said, he changed his name quite a few times as he got into the industry. All right, so we open up with the New World Pictures logo, some children chanting, and the title, Stephen King's Children of the Corn. And what I find interesting, guys, is we talked about inept advertising when we talked about Alien 3 way back when. This movie, when they were advertising it, of course, they had King's name above the title, and they wanted to advertise that. But if you watch the first trailer for this, they spell Stephen King S-T-E-V-E-N instead of S-T-E-P-H. So already we know this is inept. Now, the music for this is done by a guy by the name of Jonathan Elias, who, guys, this guy is another guy, quite a resume, and he has a connection to the series that we just did because he worked on that iconic trailer music that they did for Alien. That trailer that they showed of Ripley running through the ship and things, that was done by this guy, the music. And he did the Blade Runner and Back to the Future trailers as well. And the music that plays behind the Columbia Pictures logo that premiered before Last Action Hero, a theme that they still use to this day. An eclectic resume, a very respectable resume, but I don't think this is a very good score. It has moments when I like it, but it gets kind of cheesy for 1984 standards. Adam, what do you feel about the score of this?
I think it exists. I think of all the things in this movie, the score is there. It feels very 80 perfunctionary for a film of this ilk.
Yeah, so we see some corn in an abandoned town as we cut to a church in Gatlin, Nebraska, 3 years before the story takes place. And that is already a change from the story, because in the story, it's actually about 10 years. So there's a change. Another change we get is we get a voiceover from this kid, Job, whose dad didn't like Isaac. Now, George Goldsmith, when he was doing the script, he didn't want to see it from the adult's point of view. He wanted to get it from a kid's point of view. So he made up these two characters, this Job and Sarah. I don't like that choice. I think when you deviate from that story, and we'll talk about the scene that happens here in a bit, I don't know. I think that deviates a little too much. And this voiceover, this poor kid cannot read these lines very well.
The opening prologue to this movie is detrimental to the finished product. I'll save my thoughts more as we get into the scene that follows, but perspective is a big, I think that's a big problem with this movie, in that because the kids are the focus, I don't 100% buy then the rationale of still bringing in the outsiders if you're going to create ancillary characters who are technically the protagonists and also narrate full perspective of the movie. So this change I don't understand. I think his narration is awful. And I think the two kids, yeah, they look all cute and innocuous, but do a few more takes on their lines next time. I mean, it's not quite Cortland Mead territory, but it's somewhere in that cornfield. You just have to find it.
Yeah, well, these two kids, they would go on to okay careers. The one kid would go on to be in the Monster Squad, and the girl would actually be in Full House and Fuller House. So she put together quite a career after this.
If you're going to start with a voiceover, I don't know if the kid voiceover is the way to do it. To Matt's point, starting it this way is pretty detrimental. It takes away some of the suspense. Because you know kind of the how and whys right off the bat. If this was a mid-movie or even third act type of reveal, I think it could add some real punch. But I'll say, never having seen it, and I did not read the story until after I watched this film, I was shocked that we were starting out with just a full-blown massacre of adults here in this town. Because I sure as hell didn't expect it.
This is the second fucking Stephen King property where one of the main characters is named Job.
Yes. I was getting to that.
From the same series of books.
So let's get to our two, I guess we could call them our two villains of this. We have Malachi and we have Isaac. Now, the kid who plays Isaac, another interesting story. This kid, he's not a kid when he makes this movie. He's actually 23 years old. He has a birth defect. And Matt, you're going to love this. He has this haircut because when he went to audition for this, he had just done a commercial for the Star Trek Atari game, and he was a Vulcan, and he walked in, and
the producers were like, dude, perfect. We're going to keep that haircut. So he got the role, and he really took this role serious. He went and he studied sermons. He went and studied kid preachers, and he really wanted to get this down. I think this kid, his name's John Franklin, this guy, I think he does a pretty good job here. I like him. I think there are moments, especially when he's looking through this window, that he's pretty creepy, pretty big presence in this. Malachi, he's Courtney Gaines, another interesting cat. When he went into audition, he grabbed one of the producers, had a fake knife, and pretended to hold him hostage. Why Kearse decided to keep him after that instead of throwing him in jail, I don't know. He is another one. He really wanted this. I think this guy is more known to me for being in Can't Buy Me Love, but I think he's a pretty good presence in this as well. I like our two main antagonists in this.
I think they're kid actors. I think one overacts to the point that I could use about 50% less of every speaking line that he's given. And the other one makes me think that I'm somewhere in upstate Pennsylvania because of the way that he looks. And I think I'm going backwards, not in Kentucky or Kansas, wherever the hell this is supposed to take place. They're okay. They're kid actors. You know, I think John Franklin does a decent job. Courtney Gaines, he grates on me pretty quickly. The scene that we get halfway through this film that I think everybody has seen clips, I think everybody has seen made fun of, whether it's freaking Family Guy, South Park, anything else. It's just by the time it gets there, I'm over it and I'm over him pretty quick just because you can overact with an adult and I think they have the quality for it. When a child overacts, it just gets really hokey. And I know I'm complaining about hokey in Children of the Corn, but it works until it doesn't.
Keep John Franklin in mind. We will be talking about him down the road.
Well, given the fact this takes place in an agricultural farm community, his should have changed his last name to Grades, because he grades on me pretty quickly, to Adam's point. This is what happens when you get kids who are too excited to be in a movie, and you don't have a director who knows to tell them to pull back. In the case of Isaac, can't really call him a kid actor, because he's in his 20s.
Yeah, he's 23.
But it's funny that the haircut story, but yet they still give him that giant preacher Undertaker hat for... Most of the scenes he's in. So it's kind of like, yeah, you see it here and there, but it's not like it's on full display. It's pure coincidence. I think he's fine. My compliments to the casting director to find two butt-ass ugly kids to play these two parts. And I think this is the movie, to Adam's point, that put the genesis of the idea of ginger kids being evil in pop culture.
So let's get to this notorious scene. We go to this diner, and man, that shake looks good. We're seeing a sick girl in bed as a boy looks through the window. And then we go in the diner where coffee is ingested and choked on. This is poison coffee as kids take knives and swords to the remaining adults. And we have hands in meat cutters, which King would take this and run with a couple of years later when we get to Maximum Overdrive, which we covered a couple years ago in the archives. But this scene, it's a very good scene because let's not forget we are in the midst of the slasher era in 1984. Friday the 13th, the final chapter, would be this year as well. I think this is a pretty good scene. My problem with it, and Adam, you touched on this already, but in the story, this whole town and the two characters who are going to enter it is handled as a mystery. When you show this scene, the mystery's already gone. We know what's going on. So in that way, I think it really takes away from the gist of what that story was actually about.
The biggest problem with this movie is that it leaves nothing to the imagination. It is way too straightforward with everything, which I guess is in line with Stephen King, because I do criticize him of either over-explaining what's happening or explaining it whatsoever. Sometimes it's better off being ambiguous. The fact that the movie plays its hand this quickly, there's no surprise. So when the characters stumble into this town, we as the audience are already in on it, and as a result, so much of this movie feels like I'm sitting on my hands waiting for something to happen that I know is actually happening just because it'll be exciting. So I think this is, from a filmmaking perspective, I think this is a very illogical, and the word I used earlier, detrimental to the overall movie. There's a Spanish movie called Who Can Kill a Child that came out about 10 years before this. And what's great about that film, almost an identical premise, except there's no supernatural cult per se. The kids are just evil. The people just show up on the island and the kids have already taken over. And that's where like the titular, they're really put in the spot of who can kill a child. And the answer is yes, because there's nothing more satisfying than seeing a snotty little kid get a shotgun blast to the face. And mind you, this is a movie that came out in like the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And that movie's far more hardcore than anything you see in this quote-unquote movie. So 10 minutes in, 5 minutes in, I'm already hating this and I'm saying, oh God, there's 10 more of these goddamn movies. This is the one that started this trend. If I'm already not liking this one, I want to crucify myself so I don't have to watch these.
That's interesting. I would have thought you would have actually liked this scene. So do you like the actual scene, or do you just hate what it does to the story itself?
It's shot well, but I think it's a huge impairment on the overall movie and how it tells its story.
Ah, that's interesting.
I agree with it in that realm. Having read the story, you know, and in the story, it's, the mystery's kind of doled out a little bit. And even for a short, it at least keeps you in suspense. This takes that suspense away. And to Matt's point, I think that is a detriment. On the other side, it's a slasher, and it kind of needs to do something, and you're adapting a, what is it, like 26-page book into screen, so you got to change something. I think this could have been done differently. And to Matt's point, it's shot well, like it's effective in that way, and being that I didn't read it until afterwards, it at least shocked me. My first note was, holy crap, I can't believe we're starting with a massacre, because I did not think this is how this was going to go, though I'm going to put it right here on Front Street. It took me about 10 minutes to realize that I think for my entire life had always confused Children of the Dam, Children of the Corn, and never knew which one was which. Because the posters after one all looked the same. Yeah. At that point, I'm just like, all right, let me sit back and figure out what I'm going
to
get.
The way to fix it is you can have the massacre, but you remove the element of the kids stabbing and putting the guy's hand in the belly slicer. You see like a hand put arsenic in the coffee and everyone just dies.
Yeah.
You don't show a kid's face, you just see the hand. So you have still of some semblance of what actually happened. And you can still have that reveal of, oh, the kids are evil around the time the characters discover it, that the Drifters.
And maybe still even have Isaac watching from outside the window or something like that, that the only perspective you see is Isaac, and you don't know that he's controlling all the kids in the town.
The original script that King wrote had 35 pages of Vicky and Bert arguing in the car, and a little bit of the origin of these kids and how they came to be in this town. This really condenses that. We'll get to Vicky and Bert here in a bit, but this condenses the second part of that, where, like you guys have already outlined, it takes the mystery completely away. I don't know if I would have liked to see Peter Horton and Linda Hamilton arguing for 35 minutes, but that is what King had originally wrote. And if I think about it in those terms, if I think about it in the terms of, again, we're in the midst of a part of horror that was really lucrative at that time, I could see their instinct to change it to this, yet they also take a little bit of the edge away when you have a kid do a voiceover. So tit for tat, it's not a really good decision in the overall arc of this story. So we see that Sarah, she's been drawing pictures, and that is our pre-title sequence, boys, as the pictures flash before the screen. We cut to present day as Peter Horton and Sarah Connor herself, Linda Hamilton, they wake up out of bed. Now, Peter Horton is a guy who, he is probably best known for being married to Michelle Pfeiffer for like 8 years.
Yeah.
He did have a role on 30-something. He was a part of that show for quite a while. And the thing I knew him as for many years, Adam, was a movie called Side Out, where him and C. Thomas Howell play beach volleyball for an hour and a half. Courtney Thorne Smith. Head of hair. Yes. A movie from the late 80s, early 90s that is just ridiculous. And here we have Linda Hamilton. Now, Hamilton, in later years, she did not denounce the experience of making this movie. She did say that when they cut the budget, it really affected it because the things that she liked in the script were not included because of those budget cuts. And she did think at the time that before her career even really got springboarded, that this would kind of kill her career before it even got going. But she never denounced the making of this. Peter Horton, on the other hand, he said, I read the script, I liked it, and the movie didn't come out that good, is pretty much all he said. What do we think of our two leads here?
I think that, at least in the film version of it, thank goodness I get two characters that I can decently like. These two are despicable in the book. Like, I'm rooting for the kids to kill them as quick as possible in the book. So, at least here, there are two characters that I like, I enjoy, and I had no idea Linda Hamilton was in this movie.
Really?
So I just never knew. I was absolutely blown away. So that was, you know, that was cool. And then I'm suddenly like, hey, Linda Hamilton, okay, James Cameron, Alien, Terminator, you know, it just goes 6 degrees of everything. But I think they're actually well for what they are. It's amazing that Linda Hamilton is supposed to be so much younger and he's a little bit of an older doctor, because Linda Hamilton, she feels perpetually like early 30s, you know? Even when she's supposed to be playing like 20, 22. But I think they're actually fine. I think that their chemistry together kind of comes through here.
It needs to be said, too, that this came out in March. Terminator would come out 7 months later. So her big role would come out, you know, 7 months later. So her career did not get killed. She ended up having a pretty good one after this.
This is a prequel to Dumb and Dumber. It's called Bland and Blander. And that's kind of in lockstep with a lot of Stephen King protagonists up at this point. Especially, like, I was thinking of Salem's Lot a lot, no pun intended, with these two characters, because I'm like, they're serviceable, they're functional as far as having a basis of dimension. I only like them in comparison to the two characters in the book who are just detestable. The novel is basically when it's them in the car, it's that scene in Before Midnight when they're driving and they have the kids in the back and there's insinuations that their marriage is on the rocks. This takes that to like the 10th degree, where you want the truck from Maximum Overdrive to just plow into them and wipe them off the face of the planet. Here, I don't hate them to that extent, but I don't find either of them all that interesting. And really, I'll say this, much like a lot of the Night Shift adaptations, this would have been a great 30-minute episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Well, it was a great 12-minute part called Disciples of the Crow that we covered last year.
Yeah, I think that short we covered is, is better than this.
Vicky wishes Bert a happy birthday as she serves a cupcake, which I thought was a cute scene. And the thing about these characters, they're not detestable. All they are is in between advancing in their relationship, because she wants a proposal, which he doesn't want to give. And of course, she's going to want a family. We'll get to that towards the end of this film. But they're not as detestable. And I think Goldsmith worked really hard to try to make them as likable as possible and go away from the story that the three of us have been talking about.
Well, if you made them truly unlikable like the book, this would have just been even more symbiotic of like the Friday the 13th protagonist, where they're just there to be killed. Like it would be a full-blown slasher movie.
We do get Chekhov's lighter here, though, as she gives him a lighter for his birthday. I would have asked for a little more for my birthday.
Yeah, right, that's before where, that's where License to Kill got it from, for the record.
So they have to start on the road, as he's going to start getting 50 patients a week as an intern. This was iffy for me. Like, what exactly? He's not becoming a doctor. He still has, what, 5 or 6 years before he becomes a doctor, right, Adam?
I mean, he's a doctor. At that point, he would have passed his boards, but he's still an intern, so he's got to go through that portion of it. But I get it. I think somebody's trying to be a little too smart for their writing. To me, it was just, he's a doctor. He's on his way there to start his practice. It's Doc Hollywood without Marty McFly. You know, that's where he's going.
For the record, he wants 50 patients in a week in a town. I don't even know if 50 people live in Gatlin.
And that they're going through Gatlin.
Yeah.
they're going to Washington, is what I thought.
Yeah, they're going to Seattle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We get more voiceover about Isaac and Malachi. See, it was changed there. Joseph makes his way through the corn as Bert and Vicky play I Spy with My Little Eye. She then turns on some music as they approach Gatlin. Meanwhile, we see Joseph going through the spiderweb laden corn as he's taken out. Not a very well shot stalk sequence. And I have some issues with Fritz Kierce's direction. I don't think he knows how to format a horror scene. And this whole stock sequence to the corn, it's a big part. I think the edge of the story is kind of taken out, because this guy doesn't know how to direct horror very well.
It's literally a stock scene because it takes place in a cornfield.
That was the, yes.
but yes, I don't think this director understands much of anything when it comes to filmmaking. Because I'm going to say, this is a poorly directed movie. There's even some shots that are almost out of focus.
Yeah.
And I think it took the editing department to make it kind of salvageable. And also, this is one of those movies where I really question the pacing's not the right word, but this is the longest 80-something minute movie I've seen in a very long time.
Stay tuned. We're going to get a few of those in the next 10 weeks.
It's tough. I live currently not far from just massive acreages of corn here in California. And this should feel frightening. This should feel, but it doesn't. And yeah, it's all about how it's shot. I mean, the DP, he must have heard we're doing a porno, and it was just, no, we're doing a corno. I mean, that must have been why he decided to show up for this, but it's not shot very well. And you can do a lot with making a row of stalks and stalks of corn feel like a corn maze. I mean, that may end up going a little too much like Shining, but you could make this feel really frightening and claustrophobic. It just doesn't, unfortunately.
Yeah, it took Shyamalan doing it 20 years later for this to finally become kind of scary.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because I have made a trip from Chicago to Nevada by car. And you do drive through Nebraska in that trip. And my God, it feels like those stalks just never end. The corn just keeps going and going and going and going. So, yeah. There is a feeling of isolation and really a feeling of being lost in corn. And, you know, we're going to see them try this again and again and again throughout the series. But I'm with you, Adam. I think the potential to do this very well was not matched. And it has to be said, too, this corn was a pain in the ass for these filmmakers because they went to this town to do this movie. They scouted it. And when they came to it, crops dry up and crops go bad if you don't use them after a while. And so by the time they got there, it was not very good corn and it wasn't really good for filmmaking. So they literally had to spray paint a lot of this to get it to look even decent.
Because then the stuff they didn't spray paint, they just sprinkle around the sets for the next 90 minutes.
Exactly. 30 years later, Nolan would actually grow cornfields for Interstellar, and those don't look too bad. Those look pretty good. Here, they didn't have the luxury of doing that, and it shows. And yeah, if you know that little bit of trivia, it does show if you watch the film. So Vicky and Bert, they're checking out a map looking for Gatlin on it as they barrel right through this kid on the highway. Again, Matt, this goes to your point where this director doesn't know how to shoot this because we do see this kid get hit, but we don't even know that he has been sliced through the throat or anything. It's just a really, really weirdly shot scene of this kid getting hit by this car.
This director also does what one of the Saw movies does, where it holds on dummies for way too long.
Oh, yeah.
It should be, you see the car make an impact, and the instant that happens, you cut. But they don't do that, and you see the dummy roll underneath the car.
Yes.
So right away, that takes me out. There's no blood trail. This kid manages to walk a considerable portion, given the fact he would have bled out in about 5 seconds. If you get your throat slit by a kitchen knife, let alone a giant scythe, you would not have the ability, at least in my opinion, I'm not a physician, to get all the way out there and stand there for enough time for them to hit you. What is it with Stephen King and people being hit by cars?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it happens a lot, yeah.
This is a trope, and that makes it all the more form of karma that he was in a really bad car accident himself. Or
karma.
He was hit. Yeah, karma. Ha ha ha.
Yep, that would be 15 years down the road.
Yeah, if there was fellatio in the car, it would have been straight out of Thinner.
Yes.
Exactly what my thought was.
So this kid is hit, but Bert is concerned about the bump on Vicky's head. Bitch. Got your priority straight there. He sees Joseph on the highway and turns him over to see that he's completely dead. Bert then says that he's going to leave, and he needs Vicky to lock herself up until then. He grabs a tire iron as we're seeing him being washed from inside the corn. He walks amongst the corn and sees blood on the leaves. So this is the mystery portion that we were talking about, Adam, when we were talking about this story. But we know where this goes. So Bert going on these little treks to find out what's going on, it takes away from the movie for me because we're going to have at least 20 to 30 minutes of him just roaming around this town with nothing really happening.
Yeah, when your audience knows it before your characters, not just because we figured it out, but because we've been told, then it completely removes from it. So, yeah, it's move along.
Meanwhile, Vicky hears something bump into the car. So she gets out and can't find Bert. We see a knife in shadow on the door as she walks, but he rises up, and this fucking scene here was not planned. Linda Hamilton was told that this was a dummy because it's too hot to put this kid on the ground, but Kearse decided to put him down for the genuine reaction, and she definitely has it because she is scared shitless when this kid rises up and she turns him over.
And that must be some concussion she got to have a whole hallucination jump scare sequence.
Yes. Our next shot is of Bert comforting Vicky. He puts Joseph in the trunk. pretty unceremonial way to die here. We go back to the kids as Job says that Malachi forbids them from playing Monopoly, but they play anyway, and Job says that he thinks Malachi forbids it because he doesn't have anyone to play with. And, of course, we have this character made up for this movie, this little Sarah character, who is adorable, but at the same time, she's like, I want $100,000 million. I don't know. Is this a commentary on communism? I don't know. It's just funny that we have these two made-up characters playing Monopoly here.
I've played games of Monopoly that felt shorter than this movie. Yeah, this every time... Okay, does this girl have the shine? Yeah. With the prophetic drawings, and I am fucking sick of psychic kids in Stephen King movies, and we're barely through this fucking retrospective.
Yeah, we're not even through the first set of short stories that he does. We'll be talking about prophetic kids a lot when we go through this, but yeah, that was going to be a point I was going to bring up later, because we're finding out that she draws things that happens in her sleep, which... Okay, I hate the fact that she draws him in her sleep. I hate the fact that she draws him at all. Again, made up for this movie, but I agree with you. I do think that the shine is on here, but if you listen to Goldsmith talk, he didn't realize he was doing that. But Adam is pretty obvious, right?
Well, it's obvious. I mean, maybe he doesn't realize it, but if King had a hand in making this girl be supernatural, that's exactly what's going on here.
And again, she's made up for this movie, so.
And if you're Isaac, why would you leave a coloring book next to her bedside?
We see a knife hit the game board, and Malachi makes his way in. We go back to Vicky and Bert says the kid was dead when he stumbled into the road. He suggests opening the briefcase, but Vicky says no. Meanwhile, Malachi, he takes the kids to Isaac, who says to take them back to where they were, and that he acts upon his will.
This set looks like they were halfway through taking down Paul Bearer's funeral parlor. it looks so half-assed.
It does. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget their budget was sliced by King himself, so they didn't have too much to work with. Vicky finally agrees to open the briefcase as Bert turns on a preacher on the radio and then quickly turns it off. He opens the briefcase. He finds a corn-wrapped cross. We go to a mechanic at a gas station as Bert and Vicky pull up. Now, this guy, this R.G. Marshall, what an interesting career this guy had.
Yeah, he went from working with Sam Peckinpah to being in this piece of shit.
And Adam, do you know who else he is?
No, tell me.
This guy is the old man in the Metallica Enter Sandman video.
Wow.
Yes. And we would also see him again 3 years later. He was the colonel in Predator as well. So he had quite the career. Just passed away about 12 years ago in 2012. But yeah, what a career this guy had.
And he did movies that were like spiritual companion pieces to other Stephen King properties, because he's in The Car.
Oh, yeah.
With James Brolin. Like I said, he did a lot of Sam Peckinpah movies. So, very prolific actor. It's just weird for him to have this bit role here.
Yeah, you could tell he was just here for like 3 days to film the scene and take off. So Bert gets out and tries to use the telephone, but R.G. Marshall says they don't have a phone. He tells them to drive past Gatlin as the dog goes apeshit, and the mechanic asks if that's you, what do you want? And he says he didn't tell them anything.
Again, this would be so much more suspenseful if we didn't know the kids were behind it. Like if this was if you believe in the supernatural, you could think this is the he who walks behind the rose murdering the non-believer. Again, I'm so sick of these movies needlessly killing dogs, pets in general, because I've seen the second one now in relation. This movie does like the opposite of burying the lead in journalism, where instead of saving the most important thing for last, it puts it right at the forefront and hinders everything afterwards.
I like seeing the mechanic. I mean, this just feels like you get that harbinger right here on the side of the road, kind of a classic piece. But come on, man, Sarge didn't do nothing. Leave the dog alone. And yeah, to Matt's point, I mean, imagine if you were just wondering. Imagine if you were hearing he who walks behind the rose and you just didn't know. The horror suspense portion could really work out here. And instead, it's just, you know what's going on. Why are you hiding who he's talking to? Because you know who it is. Or you know who, like, one of three people it is. There's no reason to even hide it, other than you probably didn't have the money to shoot it.
Bert starts getting mixed signals about what this sign to Gatlin says. Like, it's like he doesn't know whether it's turned this way or that way. Meanwhile, we see the mechanic grab a tire iron as he walks into the garage and is killed by whatever we can assume is a scattering of things. Again, this guy just has, Kearse has no idea how to shoot horror, or as Matt said, film in general, it appears. Bert gets lost in the field as he keeps driving until they end up right where they started. We then see a ritual of kids, and this is where we hear He Who Walks Behind the Rose mentioned for the very first time, and they order up a sacrifice.
I found this unintentionally hilarious because of how willing the kid that's going to be sacrificed is going along with this.
I know.
Yeah.
And it almost plays for comedy, though, because this is the first instance of something being wrong that the couple sees, this blood sacrifice, but it's shot in the way that the bear scene from The Shining is, where it's just plopped in there, and it kind of plays as comedic.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Bert and Vicky, they get to Gatlin, where absolutely nothing is happening. They walk into the diner where the slaughter took place, and Vicky runs into a rat. Bert sees some kids fucking with his car and pursues them. The couple then start arguing about whether to get out of Gatlin because they found people here. So should they leave or should they not? Bert heads up toward a door. He saw clothes saying they need to use their phone. He walks in, pulls a phone that's not connected, and then walks upstairs and starts exploring rooms until he finds a few of the drawings we saw at the beginning of the film. Again, this is just dragging this film on. We know what's going on, so we don't need to stay with this character as long as we do. That whole scene in the opening, as good as it is ruining these scenes for me.
We also know the geography and layout of this house. And we've already seen the movie do the beat of someone surprising characters by appearing in this house.
Yes.
So it's a double beat.
They find Sarah, the little girl, who says she doesn't live here and that her parents are in the cornfield because Isaac, their leader, put them there. She says she can't take them to Isaac because he's scary. Bert leaves as Vicky continues talking to Sarah. She says she's not supposed to draw, according to Malachi. We then cut to the Gatlin school, as Bert is once again playing detective. He's walking around and is spotted by various kids. They approach the house with knives in hand, some weird editing choices here. And that's another thing. The editing in this movie is, well, it leaves a lot to be desired.
I'm pretty sure the uncredited editor on this film was Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
That's how choppy this thing is. And Bert has no intention of doing any semblance of stealth, because instead of going behind the houses, which he does for one part, he just keeps walking down the main road.
Bert is still looking for a phone at a bank as Vicky sees a drawing Sarah did of her, and Vicky asks what it is. She then hears a noise. She gets up to investigate and sees the kids walking in with knives in hand saying they want to give her peace. The kids end up cornering and capturing her. Meanwhile, Bert sees some suspicious drawings and goes to find Vicky. He sees his car covered in cornrows, and as he walks in, Vicky is gone.
These kids suck at vandalism.
Big time. Isaac tells Malachi that he who walks is displeased at the sacrifice of Joseph, and Sarah has the gift of sight, a.k.a. the shine, and she was the one who warned them of the entrance of Bert and Vicky. Now, this Isaac character, Adam, I'm not sure if you know this because you're on the very last few pages, but he doesn't show up until like the last page of that story. So the fact that he's here is, again, just really... I like John Franklin in this role. I'll go ahead and say it. I really do. But I don't like the fact that he's here.
I always have to ask the question, because it's strange that the movie leaves little in the surprise factor, but it also never outright says why no one has tried to just, I don't know, dropkick Isaac. It's not like he's built like Malachi, where he's tall, imposing, and is older than the other kids. I know he's got like the scripture and hears the voices. But everyone is far too willing to go along with this rhetoric for 3+ years. Isaac might as well have the sign 1100 days without an incident, as far as people question me. But all it takes is for these people to show up for everything to go haywire.
Yep. Sarah shows Bert the drawing and says the word Malachi and walks out to find her. We're seeing the rose move by themselves and growling sounds emit as Bert runs off. We didn't see Vicky strung up in sacrifice as the kids chant, and this was an image that is very, very harrowing if you read that story, because in the story, King describes her as having, and this really took me by surprise when I read it in the story initially, after I'd watched this film, where in the place of her eyes, they have corn stalks, and that was an image that really stuck with me. Adam, that was pretty harrowing, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this scene, this image of her strung up like this, I do think this is effective. This is pretty harrowing stuff here to see. Suddenly, I'm like, oh, damn, we're escalating in a way that I didn't think we would get. And I do think this movie, this time, it's possible that she may not survive this moment.
Yeah, especially if you've read the short story.
Exactly. We're seeing a chest slit as Bert storms in a church, and the boy says it's his passage as it's his birthday.
This comes out of nowhere.
Big time. Bert throws down a Bible and grabs a set of passages, and he finds out that they all go to He Who Walks Behind the Rose on the first day of their 19th year. They pursue Bert as he falls, but he gets up. And I do kind of like the shot of the kids closing in on him from the overhead. I think that's a pretty effective shot.
Mm-hmm.
But he escapes in an abandoned house as Malachi spots him. A little pursuit happens as Malachi steps and grabs a knife, but it doesn't take much for Bert to take him out.
Speaking of bad editing,
and
how the scene is blocked.
Yes.
He manages to hide in a building with no doors and multiple windows where you can see everything. And he still takes Malachi by surprise.
Joe finds Bert and tells him to follow him. He leads him into a storm bunker right where Sarah is. Job says that Isaac and Malachi, they're weird, and they always have been since they got to town. Isaac and Malachi, they get into a disagreement as Isaac is upset at him for killing Deal, their only source for fuel. And Isaac says to go after Malachi. But the kids are pretty much sick of this kid's shit and rebel, starting with cutting down Vicky. Malachi shows up with Vicky and slices her face, requesting he come out. They tell him that the other kids took Vicky to the cornfield. We head into another ritual as Isaac is strung up and the boy whose 19th birthday it is shows up. Bert heads out and tells the others to stay, but keep an eye out if anything happens to him. They need to head to Hemmingford and get help. Now, Matt, you know the town of Hemmingford, correct? If you read Stephen King lore.
That's a no.
Hemmingford is where Mother Abigail is in The Stand. That's where everybody goes to meet up with her.
Oh, right. Whenever you say, do you know this location? I'm like, okay, was this reference to the Dark Tower? Because that covers almost everything.
Because the Dark Tower references everything. A storm shows up as we're told that they're ready. We see the ground swell up as Isaac yells for forgiveness. And what an effect overtaking him and blowing him up, huh? I mean, 1984 computer graphics weren't that good. God bless them for trying this, but this is not a very effective shot of him being strung up and kind of overtaken by this orange light or whatever this is.
This is not what you blow your already minuscule budget on if you can't deliver. It's so funny that between Linda Hamilton, you look at this in comparison to the first Terminator. As far as effects and, you know, economical filmmaking, and it's almost comical they came out the same year.
Yeah, and this shot of He Who Walks going through the ground here, this was a shot that they did. They took a wheelbarrow, and they dug a ditch, and they kind of pulled it with this airport cable to get that effect. And you guys know who built the ditch. They got a bunch of Boy Scouts to come and do it for a credit on the film. I don't know if they got paid.
Boy Scouts volunteer. It specifically says you cannot do community service for profit.
They probably got badges.
There's your answer.
They probably got badges for this, but...
You got service hours and all like for rank advancement, which there were far better uses of your time to that patrol.
They corner Bert, who tells Vicky to leave, as he yells at the kids, what kind of God tells kids to kill their parents?
Okay, this is the part where Stephen King might as well stand up and say religion is evil, which he has said in numerous stories. I think it's one of his most overused tropes. 95% of the speech is bad. The only part I like, the only line is where he says, any religion that is based on hate and inflicting misery on others is false or wrong, and says something like that. That line is sort of everything that encapsulates Stephen King's belief system, but he always feels the need to make it a sermon, which is funny for a guy who rejects religion. And how many of these movies involve sermons?
Yes. Adam, how are you feeling about this climax here?
Limp.
Okay.
to Matt's point, I absolutely love the part where it's about religion, but just those two sentences, that's it. The rest of it, it's Stephen King deciding to go full sermon mode, like exactly like Matt just said. He takes it too far. The effects and everything else, oh my God, it's just, they're horrendous. I can appreciate that King needed an extra $500,000 for his freaking nose candy, but God dang, what could this movie have done with it? Because this is pretty horrific effects work.
Just think, if we didn't have that extra $500,000, we might have not have ever gotten Maximum Overdrive.
That's a tough choice.
Yeah.
Also, this scene is directly lifted from the towards the climax of Village of the Damned, more so where he's like, without feelings and emotions, humans are not humans. Like, it's literally that same type of preaching to the kid characters. And I think this would have played better, quote unquote, if the kids were under some form of actual hypnosis or they were infected with something. But they're kind of just going along with Isaac because they don't know any better.
Yeah, they're just being dumb kids.
It's hard for me to sympathize. It's like, okay, how come Isaac never tried to, like, convert the other two kids?
And what's the reasoning behind why? What's the why? There's no why behind it.
Yeah, what is the he who walks behind the rose, what does that thing want?
And then with Isaac and Malachi, you know, when did they arrive? Where did they arrive from? Where were they beforehand? We don't have information that this happened at some other Midwest town that suddenly is desolate and the fields have gone dark or anything like that. It would be interesting if you found out that they had done this and moved on. And then I also noticed, because we're getting a little more close-up of some of the quote-unquote kids, and I feel like they went to the 90210 casting school for like four or five of these, obviously mid to late 20s, that are supposed to be playing 16 to 17-year-olds.
Yeah, it's the Grease principle.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We have 10 movies to answer everything you just asked, Adam.
Well, fucking forward. Goody.
Malachi attacks Ember, beats him down. Boy, this is a fair fight.
Not for violence on kids, but fucking get him, Bert.
Yeah, you probably cheered at this. Let's not forget, too, the book implies that Bert was in Vietnam, and he kind of looks at a lot of these kids as Vietnam soldiers. We're not getting any of that here, but it is implied in that story. That's how he sees this fight.
Does it translate here? Because I don't buy Peter Horton as a Vietnam vet whatsoever.
Yeah, that was my very next point. Yeah, you took the thunder away, but you're absolutely right. Bert grabs a knife and throws it down right next to Malachi. As here comes Isaac with this sprayed haircut, with this spray silver hair, all of a sudden with a demonic voice and a zombie face, taking out Malachi. And this was, again, a big part of that original script where Malachi is getting dragged through the fields and they had a huge effect set up to take him out. But with those budget cuts, we only get this little scene, which is a pretty unsatisfying death for a villain of this movie.
Pretty unsatisfying could be the subtitle of this film. Series. I can't believe Isaac came back. I can't believe he looks that way. Is this thing supernatural, or is this just kids that have just absconded religion for their own purposes? This is just, pick a hole. You don't know which way you're going.
Oh, this movie pulls an Ang Lee's Hulk, where I can't tell you what is happening during the last 15 minutes. just a bunch of CGI mishmash, and I'm just like, okay, I guess the good guys win. But why does Isaac, when he's possessed, it sounds like they use the same voice synthesizer that they used for the Shockmaster. And it's about that level of disastrous.
I had 100 things I was thinking of before you finished that thought. I would never have guessed you were comparing it to the Shockmaster. Oh, what a wonderful reference. God, people, look up WCW 1993. You will find out what he's talking about if you don't realize it. The storm is strong, and they hide behind the hay, as Job says that the blue man can help. This blue man that they have strung up, this is a policeman. It plays a little bit of a bigger part in that original short story, and here's the only time it really comes up here.
I like this from the kid's innocence point of view.
I agree.
As the blue man and the blue man. There's just something about Job still feels like a kid in that moment, and throughout the film whenever he's referring to the blue man.
Good point. He grabs a piece of the Bible that Bert reads, and they put together a lake of fire that is meant to burn up he who walks behind the rose. I love this next scene. So Bert grabs a Molotov cocktail and throws it, and the kids lambasting him for how he threw this fucking cocktail. I love what he's yelling. Not that way! Bert then tells Vicky that he loves her. Korn attacks like the trees in Evil Dead. Here we go.
What the hell is going on? So the Korn is supernatural, and there's a monster, and the kids are normal, but they're possessed. This is God.
Jesus. It should be said, too, that Sam Raimi was offered this movie, and even at that point of his career, he turned it down.
This would have been perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. In this era, fuck yeah, it would have been.
But also, to Adam's point, that's like Pennywise. It's a clown, okay? It's a demonic entity, okay? It can do all these other things, okay? Its enemy is a giant space turtle. Stop it!
giant
Steven, space. Pick one. No, I want them all. Give me my cocaine.
So Bert enters the field by cutting the leaves, kind of like the Guardian, Matt. Remember in the Guardian when they were cutting the tree and injuring it? We talked about it, that in The Exorcist. Did you see that movie? I don't remember.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Guardian, remember? They took the
kids. Oh, yeah. I was thinking The Guardian with Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher.
Bert tells Job to get the other valve. The gas flows as the fields rise up. Bert lights the bottle and throws it, and he nails the god, and it blows up, and blows up real good. I will say, for all the bad things I have said about this film's effects, I think this final explosion for an $800,000 budget is pretty damn good.
Yeah, I just don't think a Molotov cocktail would equate to dropping, like, a bomb on Hiroshima. This town should have been nuked with the left.
I know.
With that size of that bomb.
Adam, how do you feel about these final effects here?
It works out okay. You know, I mean, hey, you got somehow the sprinkler system to spray it with gasoline because I guess you purged it of all the water that was in that system. Okay. You know what? Hey, you knew it was going to be a big ball of fire and things go boom. I wasn't expecting we were going to have a giant explosion at the end, but here we are. It's just a boom, boom ending. And I'm like, where the fuck did this come from?
So they go back to the car. Bert says since they can't drive the car, they can just walk 19 miles to Hemingford. The two kids laugh as Bert says that they can live with them. He then gets in the car to grab a map as the girl attacks and then runs into the door head first. I was not expecting this final Carrie-type jump scare, but here we are.
Yeah, it's Billy Loomis getting up at the end of Scream. Also, this is basically the ending of Jurassic Park.
It is.
Where it's like, oh, we survived this horrible thing, and I don't want to conceive, but we're in all likelihood going to adopt these two kids.
Yeah, I was just about ready to say, so the movie ends with these two kids walking with these two. So Vicky's getting her wish. She's getting to adopt these two kids. So we have this TV movie-type ending of them just walking, and then credits roll. It's very bizarre. They have at least 19 miles to go, and there's no guarantee that when they get to the town, everything's going to go all right. What's going to happen to his fucking doctor practice? Who knows? So that's it for Stephen King's Children of the Corn. Boys, on a scale of one corn stalk out of 10, how do we feel about Stephen King's Children of the Corn? Adam?
Well, the series that I was dreading has come to pass. It is me who podcast behind the rows of this bullshit. Yeah. Am I one or a 10? Well, I got 10 more of these to fucking go. Thanks, Garrett. But thank you, listeners. I didn't know what to expect here. You know what? There were some surprises at the beginning. It works almost in the movie sense for the movie it's telling. It doesn't work from a structural standpoint. I think our two leads do a decent enough job. I think the kids alternate between creepy and okay enough. But this movie's just got everything thrown in it with no supervision, no production control. I can't believe of all the King properties, this has 11, 12, whatever it is, movies. This thing, this freaking short story has spawned so many freaking ears of corn that we're going to have to discuss. It's all over the place. It's a mess. I can understand liking the B-movie schlocky portion of it, but it is poorly made. I don't want to say it's necessarily poorly acted. It's just cheesily acted. It comes across kind of soap opera-y at points. But when you get to the end, oh my God, you haven't decided what your ending is. So you throw everything under the freaking sun at it. And this thing is a long 87 minutes to get through, man. But I think it's only going to get worse. So I'm going to Children of the Damn this movie myself, because that's what I thought I was watching. And I'm going to give this a 4, and I'm being gracious because I think we are going to fall off a cliff, and I think the rest of the corn we're going to eat is going to be rotten from here on out.
I predict you will get at least a little bit of satisfaction.
I think I'll have some laughable joy out of a few of them. At some point, I got to at least just sit back and let Stephen King take a dump on my chest and just say whatever.
All right, so how many was that?
Four stocks on 10.
Four stocks out of 10 from Mr. Bunch. Matt?
Well, if they wanted the Children of the Corn to have this much cheese, they should have shot it in Wisconsin instead of Nebraska. And much like Adam was surprised, I'm shocked this is considered one of the good ones, because if this is considered the cream of the crop, no pun intended, I'm petrified of what's to come. He who walks behind the rose, if he comes up behind me to shock me, I would ask him to hold out the scythe, and I will run into it at full speed, because this was not a fun experience. I found this laborious, I found it dull, I found it poorly directed. That's saying a lot, given we've talked about two Mangler sequels and a sequel to The Lawnmower Man. This was a more redundant experience than any of those. I'm also going to say this is one of the worst Stephen King properties as far as adaptations that we've seen up to this point. In fact, of the movies, theatrical releases that we've discussed thus far, not a whole lot of them to be sure, but I would have felt ripped off if I saw this in the theater. Maybe at the time this would have been shocking, but look, I've seen Who Can Kill a Child. I've seen Village of the Damned. I've seen evil kid movies be done much better than this. And I think it's also systemic of some of King's issues that I have with him as a storyteller that I got on my own soapbox about earlier in the show. So I'm going a stock below Adam. This is a 3 on 10 for me. I thought this was a piece of shit. And I was shocked when this was done. And I'm like, oh my God, there's 10 more of these to go. And this is considered one of the better ones. I might be like Adam, where I may have to use my one... I never break my one rule, much like Batman. I will watch a movie on this retrospective from beginning to end. If I have 10 more of these to go, I may have to fast forward through some of these.
They need to be able to have that 2x speed, but still have at least subtitles so I can read what's going on super fast.
As the King fan, as the spearhead of this retrospective, I'm not as harsh on this particular film as my two colleagues. But when you look at it from a filmmaking perspective, when you look at it from a writing perspective, when you look at it from an acting perspective, all of those fall way under par. And this was pretty much the height of King's first big foray into pop culture. This came out at a time when his name meant dollar sign. I think the opening scene here is pretty good. I watched this movie twice for this particular review just because I wanted to take notes and get as deep into it as I could. But the second time I watched it, you know, I just kind of put my iPad down and I just kind of watched that scene, just really taken in by the sheer violence. And we see blood spurting on kids. We see a whole bunch of interesting things go on in that opening scene. But again, that whole scene is detrimental to the entire film. So at the risk of sounding like I'm heaping praise on something that shouldn't, if you had taken that scene out, I think this could have been a pretty good film. But the problem is, when you have Peter Horton wandering around this town just real aimlessly, and you have Sarah Connor endearing herself to two kids who they're going to try to adopt by the end, it has a really bad mixture here. And this director, if he had a little bit of an edge to him, if he had an edge of trying to be more mean than sympathetic to people who are going to watch this with their kids and have their kids be affected by what they've seen, I think we could have had a really effective little chiller here. But as it is, it's not that good. Its reputation precedes it. This movie really did have a reputation when I was growing up as being one of those things where if you turn this on, you're going to have nightmares for weeks. If I would have watched this as a 12, 13-year-old, I might have turned from fright at that opening scene, but that's about it. You know, other than that, Isaac is a short little shit. Matt, we talked about this, and we might talk about it again if we get back into the Child's Play. But, I mean, all you have to do is kick that little bastard, and you get rid of it. And Isaac, I feel kind of the same way. Although he is effective, I do think when we see him outside the window in that hat and everything else, and just the influence he has over these kids is kind of scary to think about. But that's really all I have to hold on to as far as positives go. This is a pretty bad watch. It gets pretty boring towards the middle of it, where literally nothing is happening. And so, yeah, it's not that good of an experience. But still, I will give it that slight edge. I would give it 5 stocks out of 10. Just because I think there are parts of this that are kind of effective. But if you had a better director, it could have been pretty darn good. I want to say too, guys, I want to let our listeners know that we're not going to drag this whole retrospective out. I'm going to get to the point where we are going to post 2 of these a week to try to get through them as quickly as we can. We're not going to put people through 2.5 months of having to wait for the Children of the Corn to finish before we get to quote unquote good movies.
I wish that applied to Adam and I.
So don't expect this to be dragged out. We might sprinkle in a little more of our other films in between. We still have to get through this final story that has 11 damn movies. But I'm not going to get your guys' thoughts on expectations for next week because I think I already know. Later on this week, we'll discuss Children of the Corn 2, The Final Sacrifice. But until then, any podcast without love and compassion is false. It's a lie. Thank you, boys.
We must sacrifice them both tonight.
Amos will satisfy him. We need the woman. She'll bring the man to us.
No.
He must be taken without her. We cannot remove her from this place. It is holy.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Why don't you put that in your gut and smoke it?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Question not my judgment, Malachi. I am the giver of his word.
And keep coming back as the boys will continue going through the works of Stephen King in publication order.
Want you too, Malachi.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice. It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You guys all belong in an asylum somewhere, loony bin. Where are your parents?
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice, where we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the Mad Max movies, Avatar, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You are a sinner. You are out of fire of the corn. It will do you no good to curse me.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You know not the laws. He speaks them only to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Assuming that it's ever stopped.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You know, if you're gonna keep visiting Isaac, it's probably something you should know. It's a small town. People are gonna talk.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
But you've come back to us.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
It'll make us just like them.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
There ain't nothing out there, Mordecai, except a lot of corn. Stupid old corn.
See you around.
I have to edit those out every fucking time. I hate it. I always hope I'm on mute when she walks in. Nope.
I'm not.
Yeah, speaking of I hate it, that's a direct quote from Adam with this retro. So.
We see a dad. He goes to call this boy's mom as the boy notices Mordecai in the window.
Malachi, not Mordecai.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I tried typing Malachi. I had to switch it time and time again as I was editing this and as I was putting my notes together, and my fucking iPad would not have it go. When you show this scene, the mystery's already gone. We know what's going on. So in that way, I think it really takes away from the gist of what that story was actually about. Adam, would you agree with that?
Well, can I step in since I danced around this? Ahead.
So Bert enters the field by cutting the leaves, kind of like the Guardian, Matt. Remember in the Guardian when they were cutting the tree and injuring it? We talked about that in The Exorcist. Did you see that movie? I don't remember.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Guardian, remember? They took the
kids. Oh, yeah. I was thinking The Guardian with Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher.
Bert tells Joe... I'm sorry, that broke me. Bert tells Joe to... But until then, any podcast without love and compassion is false. It's a lie. Thank you, boys.
Doesn't apply to us.
All right. So we take five here?
Yeah, let's take five.
So right. It's funny. I got to tell you, on Prime Day, right, I put like the Children of the Corn box set in the shopping cart. I got a call from Laura going, why is there like a 10 film Children of the Corn that you're thinking of buying? The amazing thing is it had every movie but the first one in it. So I held off.
God. So it has 2023 in there?
Fuck. You know what? I don't know. Maybe it didn't have the. I swear it did because I thought it said everything but the original.
Oh, okay.
But I could be wrong.
This is the end!